Welcome. Let me add my welcome to Tom's. It's great to see you. I haven't actually been here for 3 weeks, and that's because we have two morning services here in Candlewater and then a little bit later at 11 o'clock in Greenwich. And so if I haven't met you before, then hello. And if I seem to have neglected you because I've sort of disappeared, that's why. And just on that, if you get a term card, these are on the seats, I think, and they're hopefully they'll be useful in sort of following where we are each week. And you'll see we're going back to today a series on 1 Samuel. That the last time we had 1 Samuel was when I was last here, so it was a month ago. And this is a bit like having two different box sets on the go, like if you're watching it on Amazon Prime and you're watching something on Netflix, and then you get to the end of a season and you fill in something else. It's a bit like that. So we paused our 1 Samuel series, and now it's 1 Samuel season 2. You've been waiting for that. It's out today. And we're not having a reading as we normally do, because I'm going to read it as we go through, because I thought it's quite a long, involved chapter, and it's going to be easier if I kind of talk you through it and we read it in sections. But do get it ready, and I'm sorry it's like super small font. It's kind of about the same size in the Bible, I think. So I always say if it's too small for you, look it up in the Bible in front of you. But it's about the same size. Slightly bigger in the Bible. But 1 Samuel chapter 5, and if someone wants a page number, I'll see if I can find it. Oh, it says on the sheet. Brilliant. There we are. That's the page number. What do you say? 228. 228. So find that, and then I'll introduce in a second. So we actually started this service in exactly the right way, and I don't say that to congratulate us at Grace Church Greenwich. I don't know if we always do this, but today we started rightly, because we asked the question, or Tom asked the question, who can stand before a holy God? And that's the right question to be asking as we approach the creator of the heavens and the earth. It actually takes the people in the passage until the very end of the reading before they realize that's the right question. So at the beginning of our passage, we'll see people are very casual about approaching God. They're very laissez-faire. In fact, and we saw this last month, but the last time we were in 1 Samuel, we saw that God's people were using God as a kind of genie. And obviously genies don't exist. You know, genie when you rub a lamp and the genie appears and asks for a wish. And they don't really exist. But what I mean is, they treat God as though he was there to dance to our tune. He's there to serve our agenda. Like, we decide what we're going to do in life anyway. And then you get God in to bless what you're going to do. So his job is to rubber stamp our decisions, to bless our lifestyle, to be there when it suits us. That was their attitude in 1 Samuel chapter 4. And if you remember, what happened was they were going into battle, the Philistines were attacking them, and they grabbed the ark, which is, where's Johnny's, I don't know where it's gone, but the gold box, which was actually a, where is it, Julia? Where?
I can't touch it either.
You can't touch it, that's right.
It's that
thank you. Fill it with due reverence. This is not actually the ark, but thank you for your appropriate reverence towards it. They treated the ark as though it was like a lucky charm, a kind of rabbit's foot. So they thought, okay, we're going to battle. Let's bring the ark. And so they fetch it as if this will automatically mean that God will bless their own decisions. Basically what people do in paganism all the time. So people get sort of lucky charms, or they get crystals, or they get, I talked last time about a lucky rabbit's foot. I don't think people ever do that anymore, but my mum used to have, when she was a child, a rabbit's foot and it made into a necklace. And you know, the idea is that these things will bless you and add spiritual blessing to what you're going to do anyway in life. You don't get crystals to tell you what to do, you get crystals to bless what you've decided to do. Well, it's a kind of religion on our terms where we can just get blessing on our lives. Now, I think that's what you do if you don't believe there's a real God, or if you believe that God is just some sort of genie to serve us. I was actually listening to the radio this morning. I was driving up from Sussex early this morning. And there was they always broadcast a service. And I was really shocked by it. It was from the Episcopal Cathedral in Glasgow. And sadly, the Episcopal Church in Scotland has really turned its back on Orthodox Christianity, biblical Christianity. And I thought, oh, I wonder what it would be like. This sermon. I was just, you know, I was in the car, so I just had it on. And they were talking about voting and elections and how we've got to choose our leader. I thought, well, you know, fair enough. And then they kept going. And then they didn't mention God at all for the first sort of 5-10 minutes of the service. And I thought, wow. And then they even had a reading from the Bible about choosing David as king and managed to omit reference to the fact that God had done it. So it's just, oh, let's look at elections in the Bible. So it was just religion to bless what we're doing anyway. We're having an election, and so here's a little sort of religious flavour to it. And it is possible to come to church for that reason. You know, you've got your own career worries. So you come to church in the hope that God will bless your career. Or you've got money concerns, and you come hoping that God would bless your finances. And the point is, this is indistinguishable from paganism. People do this at the pagan temples. They do it in the Hindu temples. You come and hope that the gods will bless you. And people do it in Christianity. But we're going to see today that God isn't just a genie. He's God. He's a holy God. And when we learn that, instead of us trying to use God like, oh, here's the ark, we'll just use that to bless us, instead we come before him when we ask this question, who can stand before, hello, who can stand before the Lord? A holy God. And if you're not asking that question now, I hope you will be asking that question by the end of the service. Okay, so here's a question we kick off with. Number one, when the Lord's people lose a battle, does it mean that the Lord lost a battle? So what I mean last time is, again, this is recap. We had a battle against the Philistines. We brought the ark with us, and they lost. The Israelites lost, and the ark was captured, and the Philistines took it off into their own camp. Now, here's the question. Do you work out how successful God is by how successful the church is? So if the church is doing well, then you think God's doing well. If the church is doing badly, then you think God's doing badly. Oh, in that case, God isn't doing very well, is he, in the moment, in the West? God must be a bit less powerful in England right now. And right now, the most powerful thing in England is Amazon, maybe. I mean, Jeff Bezos is probably richer than God, right? So if you just assess it by who's getting the biggest turnover, who's getting the biggest popularity, is she okay just wandering around? Yeah. It might be a bit distracting. Have we got a little creche outside? Are there others in the creche? So I just think otherwise we're all going to be... Gina, could you help and just... Thanks very much. Hello. So you're super welcome, but just for this little bit of the service, it might be easier. Thank you. Where was I? They go into battle, that they lose the battle. Does that mean that God lost the battle? If we think that, then Philistine gods are more powerful than the real God. Because God won, the Philistines won. If we think that, then Jeff Bezos is more popular than Jesus, so because Jeff Bezos won. But it turns out there's another reason why they lost the battle, just like there's another reason why Christianity is declining in the Western world anyway, and that's because God was being dishonored. God was being used like a genie. God was not willing to be used like a lucky charm, and so he deliberately let the Israelites lose. So then you think, well, maybe the ark is nothing. It's easily defeated. And then we begin our reading today. So 1 Samuel chapter 5, verse 1. When the Philistines captured the ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face down on the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place.
But when they rose early on the next day, the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon, it's not trunk as in an elephant, it's trunk as in torso, only Dagon's torso was left. That is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon don't tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. Okay, so here's the ark. I'm going to use this, it's such a good illustration. And here's Dagon. And, you know, they put the ark before Dagon so that the ark can worship their god Dagon. But when they come in the next day, they find that it's the other way around, that Dagon is worshipping the ark. He's like, you know, he's down. But more than just worshipping it, he's been beheaded by the ark. You know, God has chopped off his head, chopped off his hands. He can do nothing. So this is the sign that don't think just because the Philistines won the war that that meant Dagon won the war. Don't think that just because the Israelites lost the war, that means that God lost the war. Don't think that just because the Church of England's declining in numbers in the West, that means that God's losing in the West. Don't think just because Amazon is more powerful than the Church of England, that Amazon... No, God is powerful. He's just not willing to be used as a genie. But he can easily beat his enemies. He can beat Dagon. Now, unfortunately, the Philistines don't quite learn the lesson, do they? Because every time they come to this place where Dagon ended up beheaded in front of God, they sort of jump over the threshold. This is a special place. This is the Dagon place. And so they treat it superstitiously. Why? Like, why are you commemorating the fact that your God was a nothing, right? So they still got this sort of superstition about it. No, Dagon is no one. Dagon is just a statue before the living God. Then, verse 6, the hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, "The ark of God must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon our God." So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" They answered, "Let the ark of the God of Israel be brought round to Gath." So they brought the ark of the God of Israel there. So it's like a kind of pass the parcel. This is dangerous. We don't want it anymore. Quick, you have it. And they give it to the people of Gath. Thanks. So they brought the ark of the God of Israel there. But off they brought it round. The hand of the Lord was against that city, against Gath, causing a very great panic. And he afflicted the men of that city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. So they sent the ark of God to Ekron. You have it. Yeah, let's get this out of here because it's dangerous. Because God is dangerous. But as soon as the ark of God came to Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, "They brought around to us the ark of the God of Israel to kill us and our people." They sent, therefore, and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel and let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people." For there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of the Lord was very heavy there. The men who did not die were struck with tumors. The cry of the city went up to heaven. You see, there's no question that God isn't powerful. He just refuses to have his power harnessed like a genie. In chapter 4, he refuses to win a battle using the ark. In chapter 5, repeatedly, he defeats his enemies. Using the ark. I did a series some years ago on movies, and I called this series the Bible According to Hollywood. And so we went through different Hollywood films in the way that they portray biblical stories. So we did Noah. Have you seen the Noah film? No, I mean, like, don't. It's a terrible movie. It's just quite interesting because obviously what do you have to put in the story of the Noah story? Well, you obviously have to have a flood. and you have to have an ark. And they got that right, and that's pretty much all they got right. So they got a flood and an ark, and then they improvised the rest of the story. And they managed to turn Noah into an eco-warrior who was trying to wipe out human beings so that the animals could live nicely without us. And that isn't really how the story goes in the Bible. Anyway, quite interesting Hollywood twist. It was a sort of 21st century eco-agenda imposed on the Bible. And then I've got a friend, he's a film director, a guy called Francis Annan. He's Christian, he makes films. And I was telling him about the series. I said, well, I've done Noah. Next, I'm going to watch Exodus, Gods and Kings. I hope it will be better. And he said, Andrew, it's worse. And it was worse. Exodus, Gods and Kings. What have you got to get in the Exodus? Well, you've got to get the plagues, the parting of the Red Sea. They got that right. That's about all they got right. And they have they have a burning bush scene, but at the burning bush, instead of being a powerful God, God shows up as a little child. So basically they're there on this wilderness, and I go, oh, this will be the burning bush. And there's a bush there, and then this little kid walks in. I was like, who's that? Oh, that's God, apparently. And then he's in a sort of bad mood, and et cetera. It's like, it's a terrible, twisted film. So Noah was no good. Exodus, Gods and Kings were no good. And I thought, they're such good biblical stories. Why can't you just tell the story the way it actually is in the Bible? And I was getting a bit exasperated. So for my third one in the series, I did Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. People remember that? Had the best ever tune. I think I was in a wind orchestra at school, and da-da-da-da, it's one of our favourite tunes. And it's a fantastic film, and it never dates really, does it, Indiana Jones? Even though the special effects are really, really primitive, that kind of makes it almost more fun. Anyway, it turns out to be, shock, the most biblically accurate film of all. Who knew? I mean, obviously it isn't accurate, it's totally made up, but they're going to find the Ark of the Covenant, and Indiana Jones is an archaeologist, and he tracks it down, etc., and they find it, and it's set in the 1930s, I think, 1930s or 40s, and they go on this, and they find the Ark, but the Nazis, because it's set in the 1930s, 40s, are also trying to find the Ark, and they get there first. And then the Nazis try to use the Ark as a powerful super weapon. And it ends up fighting against them. And then you get the brilliant 1980s special effects when these sort of laser beams come out. I think they did it with like shiny foil or something with a light. But anyway, and this beam of lasers comes out of the Ark and all the Nazis die. And okay, it's all made up. But theologically, pretty close, right? I mean, it's closer than the Noah film. They got the essence of it, right? Because the Ark of God can't be harnessed like a genie. God isn't willing to use his blessing just to sort of rubber stamp human decisions, just to be on our side, to be appropriated for our cause. No, he's his own man. He's his own God. And he fights against them. Well, they pass it from Ashdod to... They play sort of pass to parcel, Ashdod to Gath, and then Gath to Ekron. And then we get to chapter 6, verse 1. The Ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months. And the Philistines called for the priests and diviners and said, what shall we do with the Ark of the Lord? Tell us, and we'll send it to its place. Now, at this point, you've got to realize this is pagans asking pagan priests. So they don't know anything about God, really. They don't know anything about true theology. They don't know anything about the Bible. But they've just worked out this God is powerful and we're in all sorts of trouble. Okay, so they asked their pagan priests, what should we do about this powerful God? And this is what they said. And it's a bit random because these are pagan priests sort of freestyling, improvising. But you'll get the sense of it. They said, if you send away the Ark of God, don't send it empty, but by all means return him a guilt offering, then you'll be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand does not turn away from you. They said, what is the guilt offering that we shall return to him? They said, 5 golden tumours and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for the plague was on you and of your lords. So you must make images of your tumours and images of your mice that ravage the land and give glory to the God of Israel. Now, you know, this isn't like good theology. I'm not suggesting any of us do that. Like, oh, God's afflicted me, and I've got a lump on my foot. I will make a gold copy of that lump on my foot and send it to God, and then he'll forgive me. Or I've got an infestation of mice, which is a sore point because I have. I got them last year. My neighbour found the hole and she blocked it in. But I found a mouse again the other day. It's like, oh, I've got a mouse. I know. I'll make a gold replica of that mouse. I mean, like, you know, theologically, what? Like, he's to say that God, what he really wants is a gold version of the tumours and the mice. But this is pagan priests improvising. But they've worked out this. This is a holy God. This is a powerful God. We better treat this God with respect. We better do something about our guilt before this God. They've just worked this out where they haven't got any of the theology that we've got, but they've worked out we're in all kinds of trouble if we do not fear this God and honour him. And so they come up with their golden tumours and mice theory. Verse 5, you must take images of your tumours and images of your mice that ravage the land and give glory to the God of Israel. Say Philistines. Dagon's no help. We better glorify him. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from off and from you and your gods and your lands. Why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? After he dealt severely with them, did they not send the people away? And they departed. So they've heard about the Exodus, about how God's a God who saves his people. Maybe the same thing's going to happen here with the ark, they think. Now then, and this is the last little bit of Philistine theology, prepare a new cart and two milk cows on which there's never come a yoke, and yoke the cows to the cart, but take the calves home away from them. Then take the ark of the Lord and place it on a cart and put a box at its aside the figures of gold, which you return to him as a guilt offering. Then send it off and let it go on its way. And watch. If it goes up the way to its own land, to Beth Shemesh, it's he who's done it. But if not, then we shall know that it's not his hand that happened to us. It happened by coincidence. Now, this is quite cool, actually. So that they set a kind of a theology test. Let's see if there really is a God who is against. And the way we'll tell is, basically, they get some cows, they nick their calves. So these cows are very distressed and they're looking for their calves. But which way are these cows going to go in finding their calves? And the test is this. If they go all the way to Beth Shemesh in Israel, then God's done it. And if the cows just kind of wander off randomly, then God hasn't done it. Let's see. Not a bad test. So the men did so. They took two milk cows and yoked them to the cart and shut their calves at home. They put the ark of the Lord on the cart and the box with the golden mice and the images of the tumours. And the cows went straight in the direction of Beth Shemesh along one highway, lowing as they went. They turned neither to the right nor the left. It's amazing, isn't it? These cows make an absolute beeline for Israel. And the lords of the Philistines went after them just to check, you know, we're watching, are they going to turn? They just watch and go straight on the, you know, on a GPS trajectory all the way. Well, it's obvious, isn't it? It's obvious that God's behind this. It was God who did it. So on the sheet, point three, thus pagans come to fear the Lord. Let me recap the whole story. God's people, they try to use God like a genie. They're very laissez-faire. They're just, you know, let's just use him to rubber stamp our own wishes. And they lose the battle. And maybe they think, oh, well, we lost the battle because God's not as powerful as we think. No, God is powerful. And then in chapter 5, God shows the Philistines again and again and again that he's powerful. He beheads Dagon. His hand is heavy on the men of Ashdod. His hand is heavy on the men of Gath. His hand is heavy on the men of Ekron. The Philistines, they figure out, this is not a God we can mess with. We better send some kind of guilt offering to say sorry. Okay, freestyle, slightly weird pagan thing, golden mice. Let's just check it really is him with our cow come home test. Oh, it really is him. This is a holy God. There's actually a little pun in Hebrew, because the Hebrew word for holy is linked to the Hebrew word for heavy. It's the word kavod. And so when we read that the hand of the Lord was heavy on them, it's like saying the hand of the Lord was holy on them. In other words, that they learned that God was not a God to be messed with, that he was a weighty God. This is the pagans who learned this. But this is a lesson that God's people haven't learned. God's people treating the ark so casually. Well, as we come towards the end of our story, God's people are about to learn the lesson themselves. So, verse 13, the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping the wheat harvest in the valley. They lifted up their eyes and saw the ark, and they rejoiced to see it. The cart came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and stopped there. A great stone was there, and they split up the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the box that was beside it, in which were the golden figures. They must have thought, oh, some gold mice. Oh, thanks. How weird. How random. And set them on the great stone. And the men of Beth Shemesh offering burnt offerings and sacrifice on that day to the Lord. And when the five lords of the Philistines saw it, still spying to see what happened, they go home to Ekron. These are the gold tumors that the Philistines returned as a guilt offering to the Lord. One for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ashkelon, one for Gath, one for Ekron. And the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both fortified cities and unwalled villages. The great stone besides which they set down the ark of the Lord is a witness to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. And he struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. I know this is not a surprise to you because you saw the excellent children's drama. But this is a surprise to them, right? Because they think, well, this is the ark. This is our Israelite lucky rabbit's foot. Yeah, this is our secret weapon. And look, hurrah. And God's just beaten up our enemies, the Philistines. Yes. And now it's come home to us. But there's a kind of complacency by God's people as though they own him, as though he belongs to them, as though he's there to dance to their tune and rubber stamp their theology. And you know, the terrible tragedy of it is that God's own people, who should have known better, right? They don't have to improvise sort of golden mice. They've got God's law. They should be repenting and honouring him and calling out to him for mercy. And instead, they just treat it complacently, like a nothing. And verse 19, he struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. He struck 70 men of them, of the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great blow. Then the men of Beth Shemesh said, who can stand before the Lord, this holy God? To whom shall he go up away from us? So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath Jearim, saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come and take it up to you. They do the same pass to pass that the Philistines are doing. You have it. We don't want it. You have it. As I said, we started this service the right way with that question. It takes them the whole chapter to get it. We should be asking, who can stand? Wouldn't it be awful if God's own people knew God less well than the pagans have figured out about him? It's actually one of the things that happens again and again in the Bible, that people with no real knowledge of God end up figuring out more than God's own people know. Happens all in here in 1 Samuel. It happens all the way through the book of Kings. The woman from Sidon, who Elijah helps. The general from Syria, who Elisha helps. And Jesus says, like, a prophet's not without honor except in his own town. All these pagans learnt the lesson, and won't you? And I guess, Christian, this is the danger for us. As people who know the Lord, we just get complacent with him. Or we think that we're here in church so that he can serve us. We think that Christianity is so that he can rubber stamp and bless the things that we're going to do anyway. You know, here's Andy Satch's plans, but now here's Andy Satch's blessed plans. Instead of coming before him and fearing him, trembling before him, asking that right question, who can stand before the Lord? And we'll find out in the chapters that come. I mean, it is possible to stand before the Lord. But you've got to come before him with trembling. Come before him with fear. Come before him with repentance, turning away from evil. Coming before him with trust in the Lord Jesus. But not coming casually or flippantly. And not using him just to bless what we were going to do anyway. Realizing that he is not a genie, he is a God. And they learn this in a very terrifying way. And the men of Kiriath-Jearim came in and took the ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Abinadab on the hill. And they consecrated his son Eleazar to have charge of the ark of the Lord. From the day that the ark was lodged at Kiriath-Jearim, a long time passed, 20 years. And all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. They're so freaked out by this, it takes them 20 years before they dare do anything. And we'll find out what happens in 20 years' time if you come back next week. Cliffhanger. But here's the lesson today. Here's the question for today. Do you treat the Lord as a genie or do you fear him? I'm going to leave a pause for us to think about that. And then in a moment we're going to pray. And maybe we pray not flippantly. You know, there can be a sort of presumption, can't there, about Christian prayer? Now let's come before him in a moment in prayer, humbly, trembling, fearfully, but with faith and with repentance. And we'll call out to him together. Let's have a pause, a silence, and then we'll pray.